This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, we'll hear about NATO's deliberations about how much longer to stay involved in the fight to beat the last remaining Gaddafi loyalists in Libya. We'll find out what economists in Turkey think of new sanctions their country has proposed against Syria.
We don't know the amount of money held by Syrian leaders in Turkish banks, if any. It could hurt them that way. I don't think the Syrian economy would collapse as a result of Turkish sanctions.
And we'll hear a poem by this year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. All that and more coming up on Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Let's get started in Brussels, where NATO defense ministers continued their talks on Thursday. They discussed the state of their now 10-year-old mission in Afghanistan, how to forge a robust common defense strategy in a time of budgetary hardship, and most of all, how and when to get out of Libya. In the end, the ministers declined to set a date on which they'd like to end the airstrikes, which began in March. I asked our correspondent in Brussels, Vanessa Mock, if they had at least come up with benchmarks that would allow the mission to end.
Yes, they have. I think basically they've agreed that it's all down to the National Transitional Council in Libya and the ability of its forces to maintain order. So moving away really from the earlier focus on getting rid of Gaddafi or capturing him or transferring him to the courts or whatever you will. There has been quite a lot of debate. This has been quite a difficult issue because some NATO allies are very keen for an end date. This has been a budget-busting mission. The nations that are participating have been in Libya for much, much longer than they anticipated. Yet, I think the decision has been during this meeting that they cannot leave the door open for a core of Gaddafi resistant fighters to try and perhaps potentially wreak havoc once NATO pulls out of the country. So they just want to have some kind of tangible stability in the country before they stop their airstrike.
Another operation that has gone on for much, much longer than anyone expected, perhaps, is that in Afghanistan. They have been there for 10 years. What is the current state of discussion about when they can bring that operation to a close?
Well, NATO is still pretty much committed to drawing down its troops by 2014, though to be honest, how they're going to manage to do that, well, that's just not clear, given some very high-level attacks that have been committed by some Taliban fighters, also because NATO still doesn't seem to have control of all of that country yet, even after those 10 years. And in fact, there have been various quite worrying reports coming out of the country. The United Nations said that the violence this year has increased significantly compared to last year. That is just not a good sign. Nevertheless, NATO is very much insistent that its forces do have control of large swathes of the country, that they're training Afghan security forces to do the job once NATO pulls out. At the same time, though, they've also said, well, we will stay there in some capacity. We won't leave a security vacuum after 2012. We will, for instance, continue to train up those police and soldiers so that they can handle security themselves. But frankly, the signals are not very encouraging so far.
But how much are budgetary concerns playing a role in the, perhaps increased urgency to bring a lot of interventions to a close?
Oh, I think undoubtedly that's a very large part of the decision-making process. People feel that, especially now with Libya on top of the Afghanistan mission, allies have been utterly overstretched, which brings us back to that warning by the United States Defense Secretary Leon Panetta on Thursday, saying, you know, we cannot shoulder the burden. You Europeans also have to do your bit because we're just not going to be in a position in future to carry out these kinds of missions. And yet, at the moment, under this current economic climate, it seems to be very difficult to strike a balance between, you know, fiscal prudence and national and international security.
Our correspondent in Brussels, Vanessa Mock. To a story now of a dictator still hanging on. Turkey has said it will impose sanctions on Syria, even though the United Nations Security Council has just voted down similar measures against President Bashar al-Assad and his violent crackdown on dissent. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan condemned the Russian and Chinese veto on the Western-backed resolution. Turkey has also started military exercises on the Syrian border. Dorian Jones reports.
The Turkish military is currently holding a five-day military exercise on the Syrian border. The last time such a major exercise occurred was 12 years ago, when Ankara threatened to invade Syria unless it expelled the Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan, which it duly did. But diplomatic correspondent Semir Diz says this time it's different, although he says there is an important message.
This will represent the kind of muscle flexing on Turkey's part, but I think we've got a long way for this to translate into some kind of military confrontation. I don't think we're at that stage, but it is a clear indication the government in Turkey has given up on Syria.
This weekend, the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is scheduled to visit Syrian refugee camps close to his country's border with Syria. Following that visit, Turkey is expected to announce sanctions against Damascus. During a visit to South Africa on Wednesday, Erdogan strongly condemned the vetoing of a UN motion against Syria. It won't stop our sanctions, Erdogan said. Turkey and either some or all of the EU nations, and who knows which others, will take steps. The people of Syria do not need to endure a merciless, shameless, tyrannical regime that bombs its own country. It remains unclear what sanctions Turkey will enforce, as Ankara has already imposed an arms embargo. Last month, the Turkish Navy intercepted a ship from Iran bound for Syria carrying arms. But economist Emre Yiğit says any new measures will have a limited effect.
We don't know the amount of money held by Syrian leaders in Turkish banks, if any. It could hurt them that way. I don't think the Syrian economy would collapse as a result of Turkish sanctions. It would have an impact, but it wouldn't stop the Syrian government from having the ability to rule the country as it wished.
But any sanctions will be hugely symbolic, further isolating Damascus. Until recently, Turkey was one of Syria's few close allies, arguing against sanctions, much to the irritation of some of its Western allies. The latest move is seen as a sign that Ankara is closely coordinating its actions with Washington, according to former Turkish diplomat Sinan Ülgen.
There have been conversations between the Turkish leaders and the U.S. leadership, and now the two sides are really on the same page, and Turkish policy with regard to Syria does seem to have the full support of the U.S. administration.
Turkey is also now a base for the Syrian opposition to meet and organize. Observers say Ankara's stance towards Damascus has reiterated Turkey's importance to both its European and U.S. allies. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
News and information from the heart of Europe. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. Throughout this Thursday, tributes have been pouring in for the co-founder of Apple, Steve Jobs, who died of cancer at the age of 56 Wednesday evening. He's the man behind the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad, and as such, he is one of the most significant industry leaders of his generation. I asked our technology editor, Cyrus Farivar, how he would describe Jobs' legacy.
I can't think of another business leader with whom I personally feel like I have a connection to. Not that I have a connection to Steve Jobs on a personal basis, but I feel like his products, his company, Apple, has touched my life personally over my entire lifetime. I grew up with Macs in my house. I have an iPhone in my pocket right now. And so the fact that Steve Jobs, as a designer, as an entrepreneur, had such a hand in all of these products that I use on a daily basis, I think is what people like me and what many other people around the world are responding to.
But at the same time, these are just products. They are something that people have to save up for. They're not cheap products. I mean, what is creating such love for these products and for this company?
Sure. I think what sets Apple products, one of the things that sets Apple products apart from its competitors in the field is the fact that Apple is really kind of an agenda-setting company. You know, Apple may not necessarily be the first to come out with an MP3 player, but I think arguably it makes the best MP3 player. Apple wasn't necessarily the first company to come out with a tablet computer or an e-reader, but you could argue that Apple and the iPad is the best e-reader and tablet computer that exists. Lots of other companies come out after Apple and try to imitate what Apple has done. You can see that most recently with Google and the Android phone. You can see that with the Samsung Galaxy Tab. And in fact, Apple and Samsung worldwide are engaged in a massive legal battle over intellectual property disputes. So I think Apple really kind of, once it gets into an industry, Apple is really kind of setting the tone for the entire industry.
I want to take things back to Steve Jobs, the man. Obviously, Apple is so strongly associated with him. But I find it interesting that the company he led for most of its existence, although there was a gap, really experienced its sort of greatest period of success in the last 15 years, in the last years of Steve Jobs' life. What is it that clicked between him and his sensibility and that of the public over that period?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that, as I said, Apple is a company that really has set the agenda. One of the things that Steve Jobs has prided himself on is that he would come up with something or an idea would be brought to him and he would define it and refine it and evolve it and innovate the design and the layout and the look and feel of a product so that they were really down to the simplest kind of possible way that they could be. I mean, you look at a device like the iPhone, it's a screen and a single button on the face of the device. You know, that's vastly different than the traditional mobile phone design up to that point. And I think people have really responded to that. I think that also one thing that's interesting about Apple is that when it comes up with these product designs, it's almost kind of innovation like magic. You know, it's like Steve Jobs pulls the curtain away and all of a sudden there's this thing that few of us had ever even conceived of before. We had no idea that we wanted a tablet computer. We didn't even know what a tablet computer was. And yet all of a sudden, just last year, in fact, there's this shiny piece of glass that has a touch screen that you can use in an entirely new way.
Apple is also famous for its art of self-promotion, and Steve Jobs was so strongly associated with that because he was always presenting new products. Is the air going to come out of Apple's balloon without Steve Jobs?
This is the big question that I think Apple fans and Apple employees surely are asking themselves. How can this company succeed in the future? With any luck, he has imbued the company and especially the leadership up at the top with his idealism and his perfectionism, and hopefully that will continue to carry Apple forward.
Deutsche Welle technology editor Cyrus Farivar. Around the world, around the clock, news and perspectives from the heart of Europe on DWTV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. This is Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Functional illiteracy is much more widespread in Germany than previously thought. That's the conclusion of a survey carried out by the University of Hamburg. But attending school is compulsory in Germany, and every schoolchild is taught how to read and write. So how is it that so many slip through the cracks? Here's Dagmar Breitenbach.
The letters blur and run together. They move across the page like worms. The child wants to stop them, put them together, and understand their meaning. But the words slip through his fingers like little fish. That is how Tim Thilo Felma, who was diagnosed with dyslexia in second grade, felt as a youngster. He is one of millions of people regarded as functionally illiterate. That is, he could manage to read and write individual sentences, but he could not read anything longer or more complicated. Now a successful publisher and author of children's books, Tim Thilo Felma remembers there was so much he couldn't participate in.
And if I did join, it was because I was cheating in some way. I always tried to hide my problem, lived with the fear of being discovered and attracting attention. It was a very difficult and a very negative period.
Insofern war das eine sehr schwierige und auch sehr negative Zeit.
According to a recent study by Hamburg University, there are 7.5 million functional illiterates in Germany, more than 14% of Germany's working population. How do they get by in a country where you can hardly do anything without being able to read? Over the years, they develop tricks and excuses to avoid reading or writing. If they have to fill in a form, they'll claim they've forgotten their reading glasses or have hurt their hand. Sometimes, they'll learn the texts they need for work by heart to avoid having to read them. With these tactics, they can hide their secret from friends, employers, and family for years. Apparently, fear of being ostracized prevents them from owning up to their problem. They shy away from attending literacy classes, according to Peter Hubertus of Germany's Literacy Federation.
Unfortunately, there aren't enough people in Germany who have the courage to attend such classes. At the most, 20,000 adults visit literacy classes.
Adult illiterates often believe they are to blame for their problem, but Tim Fellmer places the blame squarely on the education system. Large classes that leave little room for a teacher to help individual students with reading and writing difficulties. Tim Fellmer needed 10 years to acquire adequate reading and writing skills, but it was worth it, he says.
Ich würde Menschen, die heute noch dieses Problem haben,
I would tell people who have this problem, but as yet wouldn't dare visit a class, that this is indeed an important step to take. Even if it is a long, hard road for an adult, it is worth it, because in the end, what you get back is incredibly positive.
So unglaublich vieles Positives dafür zurück.
Dagmar Breitenbach, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And I'm sure one person who would agree with that is the winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. He is the Swedish poet Tomas Tranströmer. Let's listen now to an English translation of one of his poems. This one is called After a Death.
Once there was a shock that left behind a long, shimmering comet tail. It keeps us inside. It makes the TV pictures snowy. It settles in cold drops on the telephone wires. One can still go slowly on skis in the winter sun through brush where a few leaves hang on. They resemble pages torn from old telephone directories, names swallowed by the cold. It's still beautiful to hear the heart beat, but often the shadow seems more real than the body. The samurai looks insignificant beside his armour of black dragon scales.
That poem comes from the collection The Winged Energy of Delight, translated by Robert Bly and published by HarperCollins in 2004. Yes, Tomas Tranströmer had long been a favorite for the Nobel Prize in recent years, and journalists had often waited outside his house on the day that the award was given out. This year, their perseverance was rewarded, and when asked what it felt like being the first Swede in four decades to win the prize, he replied simply, "Very good." Indeed, most of his answers to journalists' questions were equally short, with his wife filling in the details. Now aged 80, he suffered a stroke 20 years ago, which left him partially paralyzed and largely unable to speak. He has since retired from writing. Yes, it's been a week of Nobel Prize announcements building up to the most prestigious one of them all, the Nobel Peace Prize. It's usually a cause for celebration, but now questions are being asked about how the members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee themselves are selected. Some even accuse them of lacking expertise and say that they are undermining the very spirit of Alfred Nobel's dying wish. Lars Bavenger reports from Oslo.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2006 to Muhammad Yunus and Grameen Bank. For 2007, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and Albert Arnold L. Gore Jr. for 2008, to Martti Ahtisaari for
the Nobel Peace Prize for 2009 is to be awarded to President Barack Obama
for 2010 to Liu Xiaobo for his long and non-violent struggle for fundamental human rights in China.
An annual tradition for nearly a century. The Nobel Committee chairman appears here in the Nobel Hall at Oslo's Nobel Institute to announce the winner of perhaps the world's most prestigious award. Swedish industrialist and inventor of dynamite, Alfred Nobel, left his fortune to a fund to award outstanding human contributions in the fields of physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace. All prizes would be awarded in Stockholm, bar the Peace Prize. Nobel asked the Norwegian Parliament to establish a committee of five to select a winner every year.
Currently, there are good reasons to ask about the prize's independence.
But now, critics say Nobel himself never meant for Parliament to exclusively appoint its own retired politicians to the committee. Christian Berg Harpviken is the director of Oslo's Peace Research Institute.
Currently, the practice is that the parliament distributes the five seats in the committees amongst the parties in the parliament on the basis of their relative representation. So the Labour Party, which is the largest party, for example, currently has two seats. The result of this is that the seats on the Nobel Committee becomes part and parcel of the everyday horse trading for various seats and positions in the parliament with, in my opinion, too little regard for special competence in the very task that Nobel bestowed upon the Nobel Committee.
Now, a few minutes walk down from the Nobel Institute and I'm in the Nobel Peace Centre. It's an exhibition space acting as a showcase for the award. This wall here in front of me is covered in video screens featuring all the Nobel Peace Prize laureates. I could have a look at one of them here. It's 2001's winner Kofi Annan. I could listen to a little bit of what he's got to say.
That there are problems today that no one...
Now, some of these have been controversial, like Henry Kissinger. And some critics feel the Nobel Committee not only has the wrong people on it, but it has lost its way when selecting winners.
The Norwegian politicians have taken over the money and the name of Nobel and are using it for their own ideas, for their own purposes.
Fredrik Heffermel is a lawyer and author. In his book Nobel's Will, he argues Alfred Nobel himself meant for the prize to go to people actively promoting the abandonment of arms, not to environmentalists and certainly not heads of state engaged in war.
Barack Obama misused the podium to defend U.S. belligerence. He defended that U.S. is waging wars and almost has an obligation to do so. It was the worst disgrace done to Nobel's idea ever.
This debate was initially confined to Norway, but recently the influential British-Pakistani writer Tariq Ali threw his weight in on Norwegian radio.
I think one principle should be that unless the case is very exceptional, not to give this prize to politicians who've been fighting wars. Mm. Otherwise, it makes Norway and the Nobel Prize Committee now the laughingstock of the world. Mm.
So if this debate gains international prominence, what will happen to the Norwegian Nobel Committee's integrity? Swedish journalist Björn Lindahl has been covering the prize for decades. He remembers the debate around giving the prize to people like Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and US Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
And what happened that time was that there was an alternative peace prize being launched. So in the worst case scenario, someone would launch an alternative peace prize, which then would be of greater prominence than the Norwegian Nobel Peace Prize.
Current and former Nobel Committee members have declined an interview with Deutsche Welle about this issue. It's now up to the Norwegian Parliament to consider whether a change is needed. Several MPs here say they want a debate on how Nobel Committee members are selected, opening for the possibility of others than ex-politicians to join the exclusive group of people who each year secure the world's limelight beaming down on this hall in this Scandinavian capital. Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, in the Nobel Hall in Oslo.
With a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day, you're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink from Bonn, Germany. I'm Matt Herman. You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, Poles prepare to go to the polls this weekend for parliamentary elections and may be ready to ring in the changes.
A lot of people feel kind of disappointed because it takes longer than just 4 years to adjust and to feel the benefits of having a good economy.
We'll have that story in a few minutes, but first, as concerns grow over the worsening European debt crisis, German Chancellor Angela Merkel offered her support to Europe's troubled banking sector. Speaking in Berlin after meeting with the leaders of the World Bank and the IMF, she urged banks to recapitalize and added that governments would step in to help if necessary. Merkel's comments have given a much-needed boost to jittery financial markets, as Charlotte Chelsom-Pill reports.
Berlin became the focus on Thursday of a series of measures designed by the world's finance leaders to put the brakes on the eurozone debt crisis. German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with the heads of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the World Bank, the OECD and the G20, as well as the retiring head of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet, in a meeting widely anticipated to calm investor anxieties. And the German Chancellor didn't disappoint.
I think if banks really need government support, then that is what European governments should offer. And it will be money well invested. The cost that otherwise would result if we didn't tell the banks to recapitalize or didn't as a last resort support them with government money would be much higher. But the first step should, of course, be for the banks to recapitalize themselves.
Angela Merkel offered reassurances that, if called upon, the IMF and the EU's rescue fund, the European Financial Stability Facility, could find the resources to aid troubled eurozone countries. Merkel's reassurances came just hours after the European Central Bank President, Jean-Claude Trichet, made his final attempt to help banks withstand a further worsening of the European sovereign debt crisis by unveiling fresh liquidity measures. Trichet announced plans to support bank sector funding with two long-term refinancing operations. The new measures will offer banks an unlimited amount of 12-month and 13-month emergency loans to shield them from turbulence in borrowing markets. But like Merkel, Trichet also placed heavy emphasis on the part banks have to play in securing their own stability.
The Governing Council urges banks to do all that is necessary to reinforce their balance sheets, to retain earnings, to ensure moderation in remuneration, and to turn to the market to strengthen further their capital bases.
But some investors were left disappointed on Thursday after the ECB left interest rates unchanged at 1.5%. With many experts predicting that an interest rate cut is necessary to stave off a possible new recession, the ECB's decision sparked immediate stock market losses. But European markets quickly recovered on the back of Merkel's support for efforts to shore up European banks, with Germany's DAX closing up 3.2%. Charlotte Chelsom-Pill, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Now to the epicenter of what's got the markets jittery in recent weeks. Next week, the Greek parliament votes on a bill to suspend thousands of civil servants and cut public sector salaries. On Wednesday, civil servants went on strike in protest at the deepening austerity drive. Amid all that turmoil, German economics minister Philipp Rösler and a delegation of German entrepreneurs has been visiting Greece in search of investment opportunities. Uwe Hessler reports.
Your contribution as dynamic members of German industry can be crucial. I invite you to Greece, a Greece which is changing, a Greece worthwhile of your investment.
When the Greek Prime Minister Georgios Papandreou addressed German business leaders in Berlin a few weeks ago, his invitation to invest money in the depressed Greek economy drew mainly blank faces and a few encouraging words at best. Since then, the chances for foreign investors in Greece haven't exactly improved. Nevertheless, as public riots over Papandreou's austerity measures intensified this week, a group of 50 German business leaders has ventured out into the hostile territory. They are mainly small and medium-sized businesses, such as AE Photonics, a solar energy company that has opened an office in Athens recently. Company boss Martin Attenhauser has a clear idea about what he wants from the Greek government. I hope we'll be able to discuss the rules for access to the Greek solar market, how this can be made easier for foreign investors, he says. We are also seeking reassurances from the government that it'll stick with the pledges it's going to make. Solar energy generation has huge potential in sun-rich Greece, says Attenhauser. Yet, that hasn't been fully tapped because of restrictive government policy aimed at keeping foreign companies out. Other companies in the German business delegation are active in areas such as tourism infrastructure, water and sewage treatment, as well as information technology. Martin Knapp, head of the German-Greek Chamber of Commerce and Industry, says that Greece has a lot to offer, especially in the IT sector.
In Griechenland gibt es eine sehr gut ausgebildete Wissenschaftler, Ingenieure.
Greece has many highly skilled scientists and engineers who cannot find a job, he says. They are about to leave their country. So if we don't give them a perspective that allows them to stay in their country, we won't succeed in rescuing the Greek economy and subsequently the Eurozone. Big German companies are still skeptical about investing in Greece and haven't joined the tour organized by the German economics minister. But Philipp Rösler doesn't see this as a disadvantage.
Da werden nicht gleich sofort Milliardeninvestitionen zu erwarten sein.
We shouldn't expect investments in the range of billions of euros, he says. But we can make small contributions to rejuvenating the Greek infrastructure as well as the business climate. Greece has two problems, heavy public debt and a lack of competitiveness. Germany wants to help tackle both of them. Rösler did, however, warn that his trip wouldn't herald an immediate influx of investments, but rather was the first step down the long road. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
The Eurozone bailout fund, the one that may make or break Greece's and Europe's economic future, faces its final major hurdle next week. That's when members of the Parliament of Slovakia are set to vote on the changes. It's something of a nail-biting finish. Slovakia's prime minister has yet to convince a junior coalition party to vote in favor of expanding the European Financial Stability Fund. Without Slovak ratification, the fund is in doubt. And it's not an exaggeration to say that the future of Europe will be shaped in part by how the vote turns out. Rob Cameron has more.
The 150 members of the Slovak parliament are set for what could be one of the most important votes in the country's brief history as an independent state, and certainly the most important since adopting the euro 2 years ago. Should Slovakia, the eurozone's second poorest country, have to bail out richer neighbours such as Greece, Portugal or Italy? Here's Prime Minister Iveta Radičeva urging Parliament to schedule a vote on the matter before the next EU meeting on Europe's sovereign debt crisis.
At the forthcoming EU summit in Brussels on October the 17th, they expect us to have a clear answer to the question of whether we support the expanded Eurozone bailout fund. Regardless of whether the answer is yes or no, we must have an answer.
Mrs. Radičeva may want to arrive at that summit with a clear answer, but the problem is that her government, a coalition of four centre-right parties, is divided. Three parties are now in favour of beefing up the bailout fund to stop the Greek contagion spreading to other debt-ridden eurozone economies. But the junior Freedom and Solidarity Party is against. Chairman Richard Sulík explains.
Euroval je len drahým kupovaním času. On nerieši problémy, ktoré vznikli.
The Euro bailout fund is just an expensive way of buying time. It does not resolve the problems that have arisen. Quite the reverse, it will deepen them because it's trying to resolve the debt crisis with more debt. This is the fundamental, basic reason why the Freedom and Solidarity Party is against it.
The plan is to increase the fund to 440 billion euros and give it a whole range of additional financial tools to help stop the sovereign debt crisis from spreading. The fund has already been used to bail out Ireland and Portugal, and a third of the expanded fund will go towards saving Greece from collapse. Slovakia will be asked to provide 7.7 billion euros in state guarantees, a huge sum of money for this country of 5 million people, as part of the deal. Slovakia has, of course, received a great deal of money over the years from the EU. But for Richard Sulík, that's not enough of an argument.
Slovakia has received a substantial amount of money from EU structural funds, that's true. But so is the Czech Republic, and they won't have to contribute anything to the bailout fund. Greece, too, received even more money in EU structural funds, and they won't have to pay anything either. On the contrary, they'll get even more money.
Richard Sulik's argument certainly resonates with many ordinary Slovaks who spent years struggling under austerity measures to get their public finances in order so they could join the euro. Now, goes the rhetoric, they're being told that after all that scrimping and saving, their pensions will be cut to save the profligate Greeks, who have been far less circumspect or honest about their own finances from bankruptcy. Most analysts believe Slovakia will ultimately back the bailout plan through gritted teeth. But away from the politics, how do people feel now about ditching the Slovak crown and adopting the euro? Beata Balogová is the editor-in-chief of Slovakia's English-language newspaper, The Slovak Spectator.
You can't really see strong anti-euro sentiments. More than half of the population, if I remember right, 66%, they still said that they preferred euro over crown, if we are talking actually about the actual currency. So there is still, like, there is maybe 30% of people who would like to return to crown, but you don't really see those sentiments.
So no regrets, for the time being at least. Meanwhile, Mrs. Radičeva's phone is ringing non-stop as Europe's leaders urge her to produce a yes vote. She's recently been hit by a virus. Most doctors would agree the stress can't have helped, but will have to be fighting fit to face one of the most crucial weeks in her political career. All eyes, it seems, are now on Bratislava. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague.
Perspectives on the news, a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned into Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio from Bonn, Germany. In France, a government clampdown on immigration is leading to the deportation of a number of high-flying graduates, even though they've been hired by French firms. In Paris, John Lawrence reports.
Joanna is American. Black, cropped blonde hair and short pink dress. This 24-year-old speaks to the TV crew from TF1, France's first TV channel, in flawless French. She graduated this July from Paris's elite Sciences Po Politics and Economics School with a master's degree. In August, she was recruited by a major French mail order company. But when, in September, she went to the police station to request a change of her status from student to employee, she got a nasty surprise. When I went to submit my application, they told me I wasn't allowed to, she said. They told me the procedure had changed over summer and that it was now necessary to make your application at least a month before your student visa expires, and that it was now too late. Joanna's employers were forced, therefore, to cancel her full-time job contract and replace it with an internship. Several hundred non-EU graduates have found themselves in a similar situation since summer, blocked at the entrance to the job market. The reason is a government memo signed by the Interior and Employment Ministers calling on the police to show more rigour in the granting of work visas to students from outside the European Union. Louis Vogel, president of the Conference of University Rectors, says the government is making a big mistake. These are our future customers, Vogel says. People who, in the future, will think French. If we want to sell our products and our services, we're going to have to need, everywhere in the world, friends of France. The Federation of Foreign Students in France also complains about the raising of the minimum financial resources you have to be able to show before being allowed to study here. At the Interior Ministry, however, they say they're only interested in tracking down cases of abuse of the system. You should reassure these students, said Interior Ministry spokesman Pierre-Henri Brondet, because the rules have not been changed. On the other hand, those who do not satisfy the criteria do not have a future on our national territory. The ministry in charge of further education, Laurent Vauquier, has conceded, however, that the government memo has doubtless been applied too strictly and has promised to advise the police and university authorities to be more flexible. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
On the eve of general elections in Poland this weekend, opinion polls give the ruling liberal Civic Platform Party a lead over its main rival, the nationalist opposition Law and Justice Party. But analysts describe the outcome as uncertain because of a feeling among younger voters that the government hasn't fully delivered on its promises of a brighter economic future. From Warsaw, Rafał Kibiszewski reports.
When liberal politician Donald Tusk came to power in Poland 4 years ago, it was largely thanks to the support of younger voters, who had turned against the former fractious and anti-European government of Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczyński. Tusk then promised the young jobs in a thriving economy, something that has only partly come true. Even though Poland has been spared the economic woes suffered by many other European Union countries, growing numbers of voters now describe Tusk's cabinet as lacking direction. Business journalist Tomasz Ćwiok believes that Tusk may have promised too much, and it can now be much harder for him to inspire voters with his vision.
A lot of people feel kind of disappointed because it takes longer than just 4 years to adjust and to feel the benefits of having a good economy.
But on his election trail, Tusk still focused on the young. His message was similar to previous elections. His party is open towards Europe, while opposition leader Jarosław Kaczyński's nationalists are inward-looking and likely to lead Poland into a cul-de-sac.
I realize that my government is perhaps regarded as less cool and trendy than it was 4 years ago, but I'm still counting on young people. I can guarantee them a safe passage through the troubled waters of European finances. We can keep the Polish economy growing. I also promise to carry on being stable and pragmatic, unlike some of my rivals. I have no intention to stir dark forces in Polish society like my nationalist opponent Jarosław Kaczyński. I'm convinced that many younger voters will appreciate that.
In fact, younger voters could find opposition leader Jarosław Kaczyński's election campaign somewhat contradictory. Ostensibly surrounded by young people during his rallies, he nevertheless mainly addressed his older nationalist voters by suggesting that the government was somehow responsible for the death of his brother, former President Lech Kaczyński, in a plane crash in Russia last year. Jarosław Kaczyński once again raised the specter of German domination. In his new book, he hinted that the German Chancellor Angela Merkel might have some darker motives when dealing with Poland. Kaczyński's party enjoys the unswerving support of Poland's Roman Catholic media. Catholic intellectual Zbigniew Nosowski, editor of the Więź magazine, explains that while not being directly involved, the Church sees its role as providing guidance to the faithful, also on political matters.
For the Polish society, which is so much predominantly Catholic, the way of involvement of the Catholic hierarchy in the political elections is important. Well, people simply, if they are disoriented, they ask their priests about their opinion.
With fewer and fewer Poles ready to accept that, the vote in this election will be as much on economic future as on church-related matters. Observers say that no party can expect to win an outright majority and that, under the Polish constitution, President Bronisław Komorowski may be asked by parliament to choose the parties capable of forming a coalition government. Rafał Kipuszewski, Deutsche Welle Radio, Warsaw.
With their Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi mired in a range of scandals, Italians seem unconvinced that their political leaders are up to the task of dragging the country out of economic dire straits. And one man in particular has reached the end of his rope. Gaetano Ferrieri has been holding a hunger strike in front of the Italian parliament since June. He and supporters say that they will remain camped out there until not just Berlusconi, but all of Italy's parliamentarians have resigned. Megan Williams reports from Rome.
Perched on a garden chair on the Roman cobblestones, 54-year-old Gaetano Ferrieri speaks to a cluster of supporters sitting on the ground facing him. Lean and with a weather-beaten face, Ferrieri has been here, just several hundred meters from the Italian parliament, on hunger strike for the past 3.5 months, sleeping in his nearby car at night, talking to supporters and passers-by by day. Ferrieri is a former tax investigator turned activist and father of two young adults from Venice. He and his supporters are pushing for the dissolution of the current Italian parliament, followed by an electoral reform to allow people to vote directly for candidates rather than have parties choose them. They also want party funding and politicians' huge salaries cut.
Il finanziamento ai partiti è cresciuto di 11 volte e mezza. Il finanziamento, diciamo, delle associazioni.
Public financing of political parties has grown to 11 times what it started out being, while costs of public services for Italians have doubled and families can no longer get by on the average income of 1,100 euros a month.
In contrast, politicians in Italy take home 12,000 euros a month, with another 2,500 for housing, free transportation, and a 3,000 euro monthly pension, making them the highest paid in Europe. But Ferrieri says the problems go beyond bloated salaries.
It's not just that politicians are pillaging public coffers, but they're also now selling off our historic buildings and sites and companies to pay off the debt. It means there is no future for young people here.
Flyer distribution and sensibilize people opinion and to change Italy.
23-year-old Manuele Emilio is one of the young people who says his future is being sold. He's been blogging from the sit-in for the past 2 weeks, posting pictures of supporters dropping by and tracking the days Ferrieri has gone without food. He says there's a troubling disconnect between citizens and those representing them.
The politicians don't represent the people, and the people have angry and broken.
I'm living in a tent, basically, or in my car.
Alex Mar is a 35-year-old computer programmer from Turin. He feels so strongly that politicians have failed the electorate that he drove down to Rome to join the protest. He says support on street level has been strong, with hundreds signing a petition with the group's demands. But few Italians outside of Rome have heard much about their goals. Another result of politicians, he says, who have too much power and not enough accountability.
We have a national television in Italy, and it's controlled by the politician. It's controlled by Berlusconi. We all know that. And they censor a lot of things. For example, Polizia o Carabinieri telling the press to not film us. And media gave us very little visibility. Basically, just one television, which is called La Sette, gave us 30 seconds. 30 seconds in all these days.
Despite the lack of national coverage, Ferrieri says word is spreading and that he'll stay here without eating until his message is heard.
Ma siamo alla fine, perché se non si fa un controllo di quello che è il valore, ormai abbiamo...
Italy has reached the end of its rope. We see what's happening with Greece and Spain. If we are not able to get our public accounting in order and change what we spend money on, we'll find ourselves with even less money, less choice, and less freedom.
Ferrieri says it's not his generation he's on hunger strike for, but the future of his children and their generation. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Information and perspectives from a European point of view. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says her government may cut subsidies for solar energy technology because it simply doesn't pay. Merkel says solar power is using up 50% of the government's budget for renewable energy, but produces just 2% of the country's electricity. The government seems intent on putting more cash into wind energy now. There's certainly more wind in Germany than sun. It's not a particularly innovative observation, but one that may have implications for German firms. Firms like AS Solar in Hanover. They've just spent 7.5 million euros renovating their offices in a 100-year-old building to make them totally energy efficient, self-sufficient, and even energy producing. It's called Energy Plus and could become the latest green energy trend, despite any new government plans. Jonathan Gifford reports.
We'll just go up and see if the door's open. Watch your head.
It's not often that the first thing you're shown when checking out a freshly finished construction project is the roof. But then again, when you're talking about the renewable energy wholesaler AS Solar's headquarters in Hanover, in Germany's north, it's the first of quite a few surprises.
So here we are in Hannover Bornum, and this is one of the biggest installations in Hanover region.
The installation that the beaming head of marketing Maike Kultan is talking about is a 2.5 megawatt photovoltaic, or PV, solar installation. That kind of electrical generation capacity is enough to supply almost all of the energy needs of AS Solar's office, showroom and warehouse. Many new buildings are being kitted out with things like insulation and solar arrays and becoming low or even zero emission buildings. But what sets the AS Solar building apart is that this large commercial building has been reborn green.
That is one reason we also renewed this building, to show what is possible.
After heading down off the roof, AS Solar's managing director Gert Pommerin sets out the idea behind the project. The firm he runs will save money on the energy bills in their new born-again building, and he can feel pretty good about reducing the company's carbon emissions so dramatically. But what's important to Gert Pommerin is that the building sets an example and sends a message to companies elsewhere.
What we have done here is the most important, because a lot of old buildings are existing, need a lot of energy, and we show with this building that you can completely change it. And what we have done here, it's a really good signal to combine renewable energy with high energy efficiency.
The building itself is over 60 years old and was in ruins before the company decided to take it over and complete their ambitious renewable energy renovation. After its former life as a radio and television component factory, it was abandoned and empty for years. And sitting in Pommerin's warm, wooden and glass office with its two-story high ceilings and light, modern and airy feel, it's hard to imagine how dilapidated and abandoned this space was just 18 months ago. But Pommerin believes that the potential is there for hundreds or even thousands of buildings throughout Europe and beyond to be transformed, not only into more efficient spaces, but also self-sufficient spaces, and even energy producers. AS Solar says they've completed the world's first Energy Plus renovation of a commercial building.
We completely make new electrical power with big photovoltaic PV plant on the roof. That was the first we have done. And then we have at the facade 150 square meters of solar collectors for heating and also for solar cooling. Also with biomass system we can produce the last heating we need.
They've also planned a ground-mounted solar array and a solar carport next to the main building. By AS Solar's calculations, the energy used to manufacture the renewable energy systems and complete the renovation will be paid back through the energy created on the site well within 10 years. But it's also a project that should be positive for the company's bottom line. The renovation costs 7.5 million euros, and there were many challenges, like getting the relevant approvals for some of the more innovative structures and finding an architect ready to take it on. But what are the wider implications? What would it mean for other power-guzzling offices and businesses to become energy producers as well as consumers? There are many political challenges and vested interests among the big power companies who may want to resist the development of more end users creating their own energy, which they can pump back into power grids. But then there are plenty of corporations that see the benefit in gaining a reputation as being energy efficient. US retailer Walmart and the search engine firm Google have both made commitments to become zero emission companies. So this solar outfit in Hanover may soon find itself at the head of a new global trend. Jonathan Gifford for Deutsche Welle Radio, Hanover.
That is all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.